Koheles, Perek Zayin, Pasuk Gimel, Ibn Ezra.
Said that you were in the Tztava from before. You many, many years ago you were in the Tztava. The implication would be that it's an old tzivoy. It's an old tzivoy. But it's not true, because every tzivoy has to be kechadashim. It has to be like a new, like a brand new phenomenon. Because Torah, the nature of Torah is such that it's a creative, it's an entity of chidush. It's an entity of chidush. And an entity of chidush, it's something that's perceived by the mind. And when the mind perceives it and understands and learns, even when it repeats something, but the mind is investigating and sees different points, it's aim based on medrash below chidush. There's no such thing as learning. Even if you learn over something old, there's always some new point that the mind perceives. So learning Torah and keeping the mitzvahs, and even and study in the chiyuvei hamitzvahs, even the very chiyuvei hamitzvahs have to be as if the person received it today, something new. I mean, in other words, it means like this. It means that when a person looks into the Torah to see what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mitzvah him, he's not looking for a tzivui that was from many years ago. He's looking right now for something new that will relate to his intellect, to his chachma. What is the tzivui Hashem? What is the tzivui Hashem? So the tzivui, when a person searches for the tzivui Hashem, he's not searching for an ancient occurrence. What happened many years ago? He's searching right now for something that's alive, that relates to him in the way of chiddush. The chiddush. What is the tzivui? The tzivui is, in other words, the tzivui isn't subject to the phenomena of time. It's not subject to the phenomena of time. The phenomena of time only means something when a person has an experience. So if he's moved by the experiential, so the phenomena of time dulls the experience. Thinks it over, it happened a long time ago, there's a wearing away, there's a process of wearing away on any emotional kind of experience that a person might have, no matter how great it is. But the emotion, the experience, over time, wears away. And it doesn't have the same meaning. That's why people take pictures. Why do people take pictures? Pictures are an attempt to keep the occurrence, the experience, new. It's an attempt. Of course, it doesn't work, because you can't really keep it new. But it's an attempt. It tries to bring it back by making, when you look at the picture, it's like, you're re-experiencing it again. You re-experience it. Of course, it's not the same experience. It's an experience of looking at a picture. It's not the same experience. But it's related to it. So it's an attempt to keep the experience alive, to make it as if it just occurred. That's why, that's the purpose of photography and the average person's life. But the reason that you need it is because really the experience wears off, wears away. In Torah, in Sinai, in Matan Torah, there's no such thing as a wearing away process. That's what Rashi says. That's what Chazal say. In other words, you are not doing the mitzvahs today because of the experience of Sinai, which has worn away to any extent over the years. You're doing the mitzvahs. Why? Because when you study the mitzvah and the mind searches to understand the mitzvah is a certain reality. Reality doesn't wear away. Reality always exists. Same. There's no wearing away process. So in keeping yadus and keeping the mitzvahs, we don't keep the mitzvahs because of an event that occurred years ago. Of course, the event occurred. But the motivation for the mitzvah is the search for truth that a person has every day. So when he looks at a mitzvah, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when a person looks at a mitzvah that God commanded him, he's not simply trying to fulfill God's request, God's commandment. He's not trying to fulfill it. What he's searching for is, he's searching for a certain truth, a certain reality that the mitzvah conveys to him. Every mitzvah conveys to man a certain reality. Not simply trying to do what God told him. God told him, he's trying to do what God told him, so that was many years ago. And now, of course, he'll do it. But the commandment is worn thin over the time, over the years. But if he's looking for a certain truth, a certain reality, then that reality is not subject to time, not subject to the process of time causing it to wear away. The person's looking for truth. The truth is he's looking for truth in his life right now. So that's why Rashi says that that explains the amazing way that the pasuk was phrased, because the pasuk on the surface doesn't seem to make any sense. What do you mean the Yomazeh? Happened years ago, 40 years ago. So what's the answer? So the answer is because Moshe Rabbeinu could not have said that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mitzvah you years ago, because then the implication would be that it's something which is worn away through time, no matter how slight, but would imply that it's something that's subject to time. So therefore he phrased it, Ayom Azad Hashem L'Kecham Mitzvah L'Asas Chukum Melech. That means every day, every time. Every time you look at the Chukum, it's always Ayom Azad. It's always Ayom Azad. That's why the Pasuk changed the tense from the past to the present. Because looking to see what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mitzvah is really in search of a truth and an idea. Truth in an idea doesn't wear away with time. That's the pshat in the pasuk. So, yes. Yes, correct. Correct. That's correct. It's not simply the performance of a commandment that God gave you simply because God gave it to you, and that's why you're doing it, to fulfill a certain obligation. That it's more than that. It's really the fulfilling of the obligation is the search of man for truth. And every mitzvah teaches a person a certain truth, a certain idea. And that idea and that truth does not wear away with time. That's what it means. The different, now see, some mitzvahs in a different framework. It's in the framework of Chochmah, of Doresh Yesod Hashem. And so what does the Pasuk say? The Pasuk says in the Gemara, says, when Moshe Rabbeinu talks about Tshuva of Kol Yisrael, so what does he say? The Kashtem Mishom Yisrael Hashem Alokecha Matzasa Kisid Rishenu B'chol Levavcha V'chol Mavshah. That's what the Pasuk says. So really, Asiyas HaMitzvahs, and then the whole Sefer Dvarim, Moshe Rabbeinu repeats again and again, Shmatam Zachukim, that the whole, Moshe Rabbeinu makes it quite clear in Sefer Dvarim, that there's only one way for man and for Kol Yisrael to obtain his salvation is only through one way. And that is through Asiyas HaChukim HaMishpatim. Asiyas HaChukim HaMishpatim. That's constantly repeated again and again. Chukim HaMishpatim. Chukim HaMishpatim. And why? Because in Chukim and the Chukim and the Mishpatim and the Asiyas HaMitzvahs is a process of Kisid Rishenu B'chol Avav Kol HaChol Nafshecha. Every mitzvah is really a search. It's a search for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Search behind every mitzvah is a search for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And every mitzvah conveys to man, to a person, a certain idea, brings him closer to his Yedias Hashem, But based upon that, what I wish to say is that in Yadus, and I said this many times before, that in Yadus, there is no, if a person say, what is a person looking for? A person would ask, what are you looking for in Yadus? Are you looking to become a London? Are you looking to become a Bucky Bashas? Are you looking to become an Amkon in Tyra? The answer, of course, is yes. But that's not the final answer. It's Talmud Torah, it's Limud Torah within the framework of perfection. And that's what Chazal were always, always cautious about. And Chazal warned that just Limud HaTorah can be done in a way which it renders it unvaluable. There's no such word. But it renders it useless. Because if the Limud HaTorah is not done in the proper framework, so then it has no intrinsic value. It's only in the framework of perfection. If a person can learn Kol HaTorah Kula and can avoid perfection, and his Limud HaTorah is basically worthless. So, for instance, Lomay Lakanter, Chazal say, is worse than even not learning at all. And a person who is Lomay Chalol Lishma, the only value is that leads to Lishma. Balide Lishma. But if it remains in the Lo Lishma forever, then it has no value. So, I'm not saying that a person shouldn't do it anyways. There's other benefits, but the intrinsic benefit is lost. The real benefit for man is that he's eventually, that he at least eventually he learns Lishma. So the Torah is not just an intellectual discipline, which of course it is on the highest degree, but it's more than that. It's an intellectual discipline that is a component of a system of perfection. And if the person doesn't perceive the perfection, so doesn't understand the direction of the perfection, so he can't gain anything. He can't gain much from Torah. So therefore, I would like to start a shiur, especially with the younger fellows, as I said before, in which we discuss Hashkafas HaTorah, because that's extremely important. That's really the Yesod. I mean, Yesod. If you look at Chazal. Chazal always talk about the not. They talk more about the perfection of the Talmidei Chachamim than about their qualities of Gainus. Occasionally, they mention about their intellectual abilities, but they speak more about the perfection of Chazal than about their intellectual qualities. So, and there was no lack of intellectual qualities, but the emphasis is always on the perfection. Gadatas always try to point out perfection of the Rabbi Akiva. They talk about his goodness, but essentially about his perfection, his attachment to Torah, how he came to Torah, what brought him to Torah. All these stories are geared, all revolve around perfection, not around so much what a great intellect the person was. Of course he was the greatest, but the emphasis, the focus is always on the main focus in Chazal is always on the person's perfection. So that's why Hashkafa is extremely, extremely important. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, the Rambam in the Zagdama, that appears from Mishnayos, speaks about why Chazal incorporated Agada in the Shas. Because what does that do with Shas? It should be a separate thing. And the Rambam says that the reason why they incorporated in the Shas is because of the tremendous toelis, that you can't separate the two, basically. That's why if Chazal would have separated the Agada from the Halacha, so the implication would be that these are two separate subjects. They're not two separate. They're integrally bound together. And if you separate one from the other, then you have nothing. And that's why Chazal wove in the halacha. They wove the agada. And really, the truth of the matter is that's following the style of Torah. That's following the style of Torah. I mentioned last year, I believe, that you see in Sefer Dvarim. That Sefer Dvarim is Divrei Musar, but in between, interspersed, is woven all the mitzvahs that were not given before, but were slated to be given Kodem Biasaretz. That's because the Musar and the Halacha are tied together. There's no such thing as Musar without Limud, and there's no such thing as Limud without perfection. So really, this style that Chazal followed in Shas, the style that started, that Moshe Rabbeinu really started in Sefer Dvar. Okay, so being that's the case, what I'd like to do is, Rabbi Meyer suggested that I take something that is very basic. And it's something that we've done, but I've done it on a Sunday. I've never done it in the yeshiva itself. Myers felt that it would be important to do it in the yeshiva, but it is really a fundamental in the process of obtaining perfection, and it's an Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra is in Kehelis. And after we do the Ibn Ezra, we'll take questions on it. Okay. The Ibn Ezra says that the human mind is broken up into three components. And he says like this. He says there's the shame. There he says, in order not to be confusing, because in the Torah a lot of these things are, a lot of times the word, the same word is used as a the synonym. So you have a word that can be used under different frameworks. So you have, for instance, nefesh. Nefesh comes sometimes. Nefesh means the person's essence. Sometimes it means, depends how it's used. Sometimes it means it's physical essence. For instance, by dam, it says ki nefesh abosar, ki nefesh go abosar damo ben nafsho hi. Pasuk says. So it means to say over there it's referring to the physical nefesh. Okay, referring to the physical nefesh. The vayi adam nefesh chaya. So unkelus is metagem ruach mamalala, means an intellectual being. So you see the same word is used to mean two different things in the Torah. But it means his essence, but there are different essences. So the isser on the isser of achilas dam is because people were superstitious and they wanted to eat that which the physical life of the animal is dependent upon. The Torah asked it. Because that's Avodah Zarah basically. Okay, but now, so he says like this: "Ye Hashem haNefesh haMesaver Lecho v'LaSmoach v'Cheshek haMishgol Nefesh." So he says, "I am going to call that part of man, which is basically his desires for food, his desire to be happy, to party, his desire for sex." He says, this part of man, he says, is one component of man, and that I will refer to as nefesh. He says like this. And he says, V'yi Hashem nefesh balas ha'argosha ha'mevakeshes sorora u'gedula ruach. He says, the second term I'm going to introduce is the term ruach. He says, ruach means that part of man that looks for honor, that looks for honor. So he means to say like this. He means to say that if you look in society at large, you'll see that there are two types of people. You have people whose essential interest lies in enjoying the basic pleasures. They're pleasure-driven people on a base level. And these, of course, are the lower parts, the lower echelons of society. People are simply interested in physical pleasures and enjoyments. Okay? Then you have the people in the society that are interested in a more sophisticated kind of pleasure. Like a person runs for office, a person wants to be the head of a company, he's man striving. Okay, the lower class really are the people that are just interested in their physical pleasures. Then you have the higher class are those people that are interested in a higher level of pleasure. That's what?
Sportsmen.
Yeah, politicians. Yeah, politician. People looking for fame, basically. People looking for fame. That's srara, power. They're looking for power. So a human being has power over another human being when the other human being subordinates himself to them. So people subordinate themselves to others for several reasons. Money, position. This element in man that looks for those qualities is what he calls, that stems from ruach. Now you see that a person who is a person of ruach is of necessity, cannot be also as much, certainly not as much as a person of nefesh. It can't be both. The people who are people of ruach actually fight against the nefesh. And that's why people always wonder. They say, "How come this millionaire goes into work every day? And if I had his money, I would just relax. The reason is because the person that's saying that is a person that only perceives one kind of pleasure, the pleasure of nefesh. But the one that's running into the office every day, he is subordinating the nefesh. He's working 15 hours a day. Doesn't even businessmen have told me that they're so preoccupied in business. Not only come home 10 o'clock at night and leave 6 o'clock in the morning, but when they're taking a shower, they're thinking about business. It means it's actually to the detriment of their health, and they hate vacations. They hate to even stop. What kind of usually what they say is they usually complain about the workers and say that the worker comes in late. How can he come in late? I'm here since 6 o'clock in the morning. The answer, of course, is he's there 6 o'clock in the morning because he owns the business. And he's getting the pleasures of ruach. But the other person is only interested in the pleasures of nefesh. Nefesh, you don't get up 6 o'clock in the morning? Nefesh, you sleep a little later. Okay? So the person who's the person of ruach is really, and that's really, if you take a look at it, that's really most the important people in society. The quote, important people in society are not the people of nefesh. They're the people of ruach. People of ruach. They're the people that are working towards srara. Srara means the part of man. Srara is that part of man that exercises control over the nefesh. It's in conflict with the nefesh. Okay, so he says those are two components of man. Two components of man. Now he says there's one more component. V'yiyashem nefesh balas ha'chochma neshama. He says, but there's a third component of man, and that is the component of neshama. Neshama is a different thing. Neshama is an element in man that we just don't even understand how it works. We don't have the slightest comprehension of how it works. But somehow or other, man has the ability to go into his own mind and to come out with thoughts and ideas that correspond to reality. This kind of a phenomena is something which is amazing. Which is amazing that such a thing exists. It doesn't exist in any other creature besides man. The only one that could do it is a human being. A human being has the remarkable ability to go into himself, into his own mind, explore with his own mind, and come out with structures, mental, invisible mental structures that correspond with the reality outside. That such a thing exists is to that same human mind amazing that such a thing can exist. It's like he has it tuned into reality somehow. He's tuned in. And he's tuned into reality in a way that he can construct ideas that are so far removed from reality, so far removed that they almost look like they have no shaychus, and they're so abstract, and yet they correspond directly. That's the neshama. That's the tzelem elokim. Something which is inexplicable. That it exists is inexplicable. Cannot be explained. That's why Albert Einstein used to say the most incomprehensible thing is that things can be comprehensible. Something just astounding, astonishing, such a thing exists. How could such a thing exist? How could man, who dwells on this planet, which is only a fraction, a speck of the entire universe, and whose instinctual nature is simply a component of the form of existences of animal, how could such a being, such a creature, span the universe in his mind? How is it possible? And the answer, of course, is that the Yadus explains, the Torah explains, in the sixth day of Bereshis, that Kadosh Baruch Hu gave man that special ability. Just like God sees the universe from the outside, so man also can partake to some extent, sometimes he thinks the extent is greater than it is, but to some extent he can partake of that ability, of He has that ability. He has that ability to partake of that chachma. He has that ability to partake of that chachma. So that is, that part, Ibn Ezra says, is what is called neshama. It's a separate thing, separate kind of a thing. So therefore, he says like this, Ibn Ezra. He says that there are three components of man. One is the basic component of the taiva, the part that wants the base desires, the instinctual, the lower instinctual. Then there's a higher kind of instinctual. The higher one that controls this instinct and seeks like a more sophisticated kind of a pleasure that concerns itself mainly with the self. What is really this more sophisticated pleasure, the higher level? The higher level of pleasures is concerned with the self. That's the center of the whole thing. Because why does a person want fame? Why does a person want power? He wants power because of one thing, that he can walk around and think to himself, reflect to himself, how great he is. How great a person. That's his enjoyment. That's the enjoyment. Ultimately, the enjoyment that a person seeks in the second, not the nefesh, but in the ruach, the enjoyment of the ruach is reflection upon the self and being satisfied with the results of that reflection. That's what it is, basically. Being happy about the self. It's something which Ruach desires. Somehow or other, never achieves it. Never achieves it. Momentarily. But then it slips. And then he's back again. And the person that spends his life in Ruach is always chasing one fantasy. He's chasing the fantasy that those moments could really be placed back to back and fill up his life. You see, that's what he's aiming for. Unfortunately, such a thing is impossible. And that's why man always tries to obtain happiness, but never can succeed. He can't succeed. I'll tell you why he can't succeed. He can't succeed like I explained once before, because he thinks he had it. Those moments when he's really satisfied with himself, he feels so good. He thinks, if I can get this to go on straight through my life, then that will be happiness. And it's an intrinsic impossibility based upon the dynamics of the mind. It's intrinsically impossible, because that satisfaction can only exist for a fleeting moment. That's it. And since that's the case, most of his life has to be spent in pain, trying to achieve that goal. But man is cursed with that. I mean, he can't get out of it because there's nowhere else to go. The only other place to go, if he ceases to do that, then he sinks into depression. That's the alternative. It's either exhilaration or striving and exhilaration or depression. One of the two. So man makes a cheshbon, maybe not consciously, but in his mechanisms, he makes a cheshbon, so to speak, and he goes on. And he sees the absurdities of his quest, but he keeps on going. He sees that the things that made him happy, he thought would make him happy, don't make him happy. He needs new things. And he sees the guy that has those new things is not happy either, but he keeps going. Because the assumption is that somehow or other he'll be able to enjoy himself, infinitely. That's the fantasy. That's the fantasy of Ruach. So Ruach, if you'd ask me, I would say that Nefesh isn't so bad for man. Ruach is the curse. Because Ruach keeps him going, and he never really satisfies himself. He keeps going, and in the end, when he looks back in the end, it all looks pretty clear that it wasn't worth it. That's in the end, in his last moments. But then it doesn't matter if he sinks into depression, because he doesn't have too much more to go. Yes? That's correct. You're right about that. But the reason why the satisfactions of the taiva leave a person wanting is because of Ruach. That's my opinion. because of Ruach. If he didn't have Ruach, he only had Nefesh, it wouldn't leave him unhappy. One philosopher said that correctly. He said it correctly, but I don't agree with him exactly. I'm just quoting him because he summed it up nicely. He says that man, after he engages in every pleasure, every pleasure either follows another desire, every satisfaction of desire either follows another desire, or it's followed by depression. Okay? Now, the reason why it's followed by depression is because of Ruach. See, Ruach is never happy. That's what the Shlomo Melech says in Kehelet. L'simcha mazo osa. It's an unbelievable word. What does the person mean? L'simcha, what does happiness do? What do you mean mazo osa? Simcha, that's what a person wants to live. He wants to be the simcha. The answer is that would be fine if he only was nefesh. But since he's Ruach, he always asks the question, mazo osa. So I was happy yesterday, so what? What now? What's now? He can't be satisfied with a momentary, he had a momentary pleasure, but now it's gone. So what? Mazel also, what did it do for me? Where am I now? So that's why he gets engaged in Ruach. Because Ruach fools him into thinking, you are doing something constructive now, and this will be something, now you have something. Could be you didn't have any simcha today, you worked very hard. But you can't say Mazarosa, I have something. Tomorrow I'm going to be more powerful. The empire is growing. And he has the satisfaction of Ruach. Ruach drives him on. If it weren't for Ruach, it may be true that a person's satisfaction will be followed by another desire, but so what? Animals don't seem to be disturbed with this too much. They just keep going. So a human being wouldn't be disturbed either. What disturbs him about it is the Ruach. The Ruach doesn't let him rest. So therefore, what? I know, but we'd like to understand why.
But either way it goes, he's still going to be unsatisfied.
You see, when I said before, I said the lower class of people, we call lower class, are people that are involved in nefesh. Yeah, but don't think that they've gotten away from Ruach. They also feel upset that they don't have what the Balei Ruach have. The only thing is that for them it's not worth the effort. I mean, they can't control, they're not enough into Ruach, you see, to be able to control the Nefesh. Or they can't do it. They don't have the ability, whatever reason it might be. But no one escapes because Nefesh and Ruach exist in every human being. You see, every human being, you can place your focus on one of the two, but you can't get rid of it. And that's why you'll see people who are Balei Ruach are also big Balei Taiva. The only thing I say is, they may be big Balei Taiva, but they're not like people think. Their main preoccupation is not Taiva. Main preoccupation is, as a matter of fact, I mean, their indulgence in Taiva is usually like a kind of a frustration, and to prove that they could, more of a Ruach kind of thing. Prove that they have it, and how could a plain person have more than me? I have this too. It's more of a drive to prove something. Not so much because of the actual indulgence itself. As a matter of fact, Pacey told me this summer he went to going around a lake where they have very expensive homes from the wealthiest people in the country. It's in New Hampshire. So the fellow who was driving around said that he never sees anybody there. Nobody's there. Whole island with these homes, 2 million, 3 million, for nobody's over there. So I ask you, why? That doesn't make any sense. He's taking people around. Everybody's tongue is hanging out. They're looking at these beautiful homes. And they can't understand this phenomenon. Why nobody's there? What's the answer? Why nobody's there? The answer is because the people that made those homes were Balei Ruach, not Balei Nefesh. And Balei Ruach goes out once, twice, three times. That's it. He's bored. That's it. So what does he have the home? He only has the home for one reason. When he can take a Balei Nefesh to that, then it fulfills his Ruach. See, then it fulfills his Ruach. That's the way it works. The Balei Ruach, really, it's an interesting thing, but the Balei Ruach live off of the fantasies of the Balei Nefesh. Okay? So If the Bali Nefesh didn't have any fantasies, there wouldn't be any Bali Ruach, because who wants to be like him? You see, it's a sickness. It's a torture. But the Baal Ruach every now and then looks at the guy that's a Baal Nefesh, and he sees that this Baal Nefesh would give anything to have this, because this Baal Nefesh thinks that this would satisfy him eternally, and therefore he thinks, I have something that's of great value. So therefore his Ruach is fulfilled. I would say that the danger, the Baal Ruach are usually the ones that... if you would want to judge, the problem with the Baal Ruach is, see, the Baal and Nefesh at least are fantasies. The Baal Ruach has one danger. If he ever realizes what's going on inside him, he's in trouble. Because then there's no, that's it. He has everything and it's not working. That's a dangerous thing. When a person comes to the realization that he fulfilled all his fantasies and he has everything and he still is very, very seriously unhappy, then he's in danger. Then he's in grave danger. That's what happens to that's really the danger of the Baal Ruach. I mean, Foster was committed suicide. Baal Ruach. I suspect that most of the. I mean, I didn't really take a poll, but I would suspect that the suicidal rate is much higher among Baal Ruach than Baal Nefesh. That's what I suspect. Because they've come to the point, they've experienced the taivas and all the fantasies anymore, and if there's something, if they're not happy at this point, there's something detrimentally wrong. And then they feel that, that's it, life is worthless and it's just pain. That's when they're destroyed. Rising up on the scale, going up, it seems the Baal Ruach is happier than the Baal Nefesh, even though he's forfeiting a lot of pleasures. He's going through a lot of pain, though. He's experiencing a lot of pain. It's a conflict, one against the other. Kind of, it would seem that he's happier. It seems so. Because it would seem that the Baal Nefesh always has a problem with his Ruach, always reflecting, so what am I doing? Nothing. I mean, so what am I? Nothing. Zero. It's a hard stuff. Now, the part of man, I'll tell you a second. The part of man that's the unique part of man, the part of man that really is man, like the philosophers say, qua man, which is essentially man, is really that other part, which is not ruach, is not nefesh. It's a strange kind of a thing. It's like something in his being that can reflect, and suddenly ideas, concepts go through his mind, and he sees ideas, and he gets excited about them, and he enjoys them. Different kind of a thing altogether, different kind of phenomena. That part of man, he says, he calls what? He calls neshama. That part of man. Now, it's an interesting thing. But what the Ibn Ezra is going to do now is essentially, what he's going to do is he's going to show you why God created man in this way with these components. And how they interrelate, and what the purpose of man is, the way he's structured. Not what the purpose, ultimately there's no purpose in anything. Because purpose is a human idea. And God doesn't have any purpose. It's a human concept, purpose. You know, we don't attribute purpose to God. Rambam talks about it in the Morning of Ochim. Man has a purpose, because he has a need, so he has a purpose. God doesn't have any purpose. But only in a limited sense, But not in the ultimate picture. There's no God doesn't have any purpose. Ascribing purpose to God is like ascribing another kind of human trait to a Kadosh Baruch. Okay, but let us go further. It's like this. He says ubeschaber. He says v'yadua. He says nice like this. It's known ki bezgaber. What you say ki bezgaber hanefesh tchilo techlash haneshama. They lokach lamod lefaneah bavur yosa guf v'chol yitzra of ozrim osa al kain hamisasek b'chilo shtia lo yechkam olam. He says like this. He says the person spends his life, sinks into nefesh, he will never be able to have chach. That's what he says. Impossible. That's what he says. He says hamisasek b'chilo shtia lo yechkam olam will never become a chach. That's an interesting thing. That reminds you, what does it remind you of in the Torah? Reminds you of one parasha in the Torah. The mind of the Parsha of Ben Tzeramara. Ben Tzeramara. Ben Tzeramara means that the Torah is giving a description of a person that we're at the age of puberty, where he's making the transition, this individual has basically sunk all his energies into achilus siyah, which means into nefesh. He has reduced himself totally to a nefesh. And that's what the Ibn Ezra says, that if the energies go into nefesh, really essentially into nefesh, lo yechkam la'olam, it's impossible for the neshama to operate, to function. Interesting thing. Why? Why should it be that way? Why should it be that way? Let's go a little further. Let's get the whole picture, I'll say. Then it's like this. U'bischaber ha'neshama im ha'ruach k'natschenu ha'nefesh. Oz tipakachna ma'at inei ha'neshama. Lahovin chachmos. Lahovin chachmos. Lachem lo sucha la das ha chachmos ho el yonos. Chachmos ha gvios, I see, the physical. Lachem lo sucha la das ha chachmos ho el yonos. Vavur koch ha ruach ha mevakesha srara. Okay, vihi am lido akas. And now he says like this. Now he says like this. He says, an interesting thing. He says that when the... when the neshama combines with the ruach, when the neshama combines with the ruach, he says, so it can defeat the nefesh. It can defeat the nefesh. He says, then the eyes of the neshama open up a little bit till it can understand the certain kind of chachmas. Limited. The chachmas agvir, the physical chachmas. It can understand the physical chachmas, but it can't understand the chachmas al yonos. An interesting thing. See what he means over that. But let's just take it slowly. So what he's saying is like this, that if a person is sunk in nefesh, in the nefesh, so then chachma is impossible for him. Chachma is impossible for him. Why? Because he says, you see what he says? So why is it impossible? He says like this. He says, Bavur heyoso guf v'chol yitzrov oz rimoso. What does he mean? He means the pull is a direct draw. It's a direct draw on all the energies. So the taivas, you see, the taivas are, since man is really instinctual, so it means if man engages in the instinctual, if man could engage himself in the instinctual, if you gotta remember, there's always a little bit of ruach, but it depends on how a person directs his energy. He can focus essentially on nefesh. If he focuses on nefesh, so then his chachma's gone. Because it draws, since man by nature is instinctual, because that's what he is, the nefesh abahami is the basis of his existence. It's the most powerful draw. The power is so great, the draw is so great, that once he's in that, it's impossible. It's like a magnet. It draws all the energy, and he can't get out of it. There's nothing, the chachma is impossible. An interesting thing. It's an amazing thing. What's amazing about man is like this, that the most powerful part of his nature is, man has really two parts to him. One part is the energy is unbelievable. Power of the force is so great. That's what Chazal say in Sukkah, that even a tzaddik doesn't understand how big the Yetzer is. Even the biggest tzaddik does not understand how powerful the Yetzer is. Yemos HaMashiach, Chazal say, God will reveal how powerful the Yetzer is. But even the biggest tzaddik doesn't understand it. He thinks it's less than it is. But the draw is unknown to him, but it's unbelievably powerful. Then there's another part of man which deals with reality. That's the neshama. Actually, in terms of the energy's attachment to it, it's weak. It couldn't stand the chance if man were just nefesh and neshama, the neshama would not stand a chance. Not stand a chance. And that's one. That's what we explained, actually, in retrospect, I see, where we explained the whole the Bereshis by Adam Arishon. Well, before Kosvodah, man originally had two components. He had nefesh, and then he had the neshama. You see, he couldn't survive. couldn't survive. Even the first man, even the most perfect creature, because Adam Rishon was the most perfected, because it was Yitzir Kapo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Even that human being couldn't make it. That means when the draw is too powerful, man has two things. There's one thing that is so real that it's amazing that he sees that he could see reality. One part of him could see reality. This is real. The other part of him has nothing to do with reality. Matter of fact, it's crazy. He could see it's crazy. He could see it's driving him to places that's going to destroy him. So he's caught between two worlds. One is powerful because it's real, and another one is powerful because of the draw of the emotion. That's how man is created, and that's what he's caught up in. That's really Bechira Chashis. What is Bechira? A power of reality is real. So he's confronted with two things working on him at the same time. He can make a choice. Either he could follow that which is real, or he could follow that which is the powerful draw. That's Bechira. That's a human being's Bechira. Now what he says is that if that were all he had, he not only would he fail, he simply would never even be able to see the reality. Because the nefesh would soak up all the energy. Because the nefesh of Bahami, it's a direct route. A direct route between the energy and between the nefesh. And since it's so, the components are so closely related, There's no way that the person could pull himself away from it. The power of the draw of the instinct is too great. That's what he says. Okay, we'll stop here. Just to give you like a more graphic description. See, it comes out like this, that man is drawn in two different ways, by two different forces. And this is the interesting thing. According to Ibn Ezra, it's like this. On the one hand, you're drawn to something, and the power of the draw is the force. The force. It would be like if I had a blackboard, I'd show you, like you have like this, like you have a V, let's say. Okay? And then the end of the V, I would have a circle on each side. Okay, so you have a V, and at the points of the V, I'd have two circles. But the difference would be like this. On the one, the actual V itself, the V itself would represent the amount of energy of the human being. Okay? What? The amount of energy of the person. And the circle at the end would be the object that the energy is attracted to. Okay? So I want to give you a little bit of a graphic description. Now, I would have it like this. That on one side, the lines of the V would be very thick. You'd have a lot of the line of the V would be extremely thick. And the circle would be very small. On the other side, the line of the V would be very thin, but the circle would be very great. Okay? What I mean is like this, that on the one hand, the attraction of the person is, the strength of the attraction is because of the investment of energy into the area. That's the tivus. But what it's attracted to is very weak because it has no basis in reality. You see? It's really a very flimsy kind of a thing. You understand? That's very small. On the other hand, man has a small amount of energy that's going to something which is very real. So the power of the attraction is not because of the strength of the energy, but because of the substance that it's attracted to. You understand what I mean? That really is a schematic description of what a human being is confronted with. Okay? On the one hand, tremendous, powerful energy, instinctual force, but its attraction is to something which is not in existence, not real. On the other hand, the thing that it's attracted to is the most powerful thing. It's reality. It's true. But the amount of energy is very weak. And Bechira means to make a choice between those two worlds. And that's why I mentioned when I spoke about Bechira, there's a tape on Bechira, right? Right? Now, what I'm saying is man is at the vertex of the V. Man is at the vertex. He's at the vertex. Okay? Before I mentioned that Bechira, people don't understand what Bechira is. Because people think Bechira is, if you take a course in college on free will, they'll say that the free will is you got in the morning, you want to do this, you want to do that, and then you change your mind. And well, was that free will? Well, it's not free will. That is not free will. That is, there's the Pasuk in the Pasuk there says, Chazal say on the Pasuk, where it says, Reina sat lefnecha mayom, bracho klolak. So Chazal say that, what does it mean? Until that day, you never had Bechira. Until that day, there was no Bechira. So Chazal say, because until that day, Chazal say there was no Bechira. Why was there no Bechira until that day? Because Bechira can only take place when a person perceives perceives reality. Until that time, it's just emotions, and all the decisions he makes is just a tug of war between one emotion and another. That's the mistake that they make when they talk about free will. When you see the modern philosophers talk about free will, they don't identify free will first. You have to be able to identify the subject matter first before you can talk about it. So they think free will is any decision you make is free will. No! Decisions, you can make 100 decisions a day, has nothing to do with free will. It's simply a tug of war between one emotion and another. You got up in the morning, you want to do this. Then another emotion hits you, so you change your mind. You're not making decisions. You're in one framework. The framework is taiva. But now and then, you get hit from different taivas, so therefore you change your mind. So it looks like an act of free will. That's not free will at all. Free will is one thing, what the Torah says. Reina sadaf necha mayom, esachayim esamodas, uvachata vachayim aman tichyata vazarecha. It means, Bechira demands, and what Bechira is, when you're making a choice between two worlds, where on the one side you feel the tug of the emotions, and on the other side you see the reality. That is an act of Bechira. Very few people in their lives really engage in an act of Bechira. So it's a person that does is on a very high level, because it means that he has both. It means he understands the pasuk. But a person who has no knowledge, this is not a matter of Bechira. It's just a matter of which emotion is going to be stronger. That's what looks like Bechira. That's what the modern philosophers call that free choice. That's not what we call free choice. All free choice is a different kind of a concept altogether. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
You see, although it's not totally, they're totally different, but they're not totally different either. Why? I'll tell you why. Because since the ultimate thing that the person is looking for is the good, you see, so there is a common denominator. That's why he's making a choice. The person has to make a choice between two ideas of good. One idea of good is one that's appealing, and the other one is the one that the mind perceives. So the mind perceives. That the problem, in this society there's no Bechira. Because in this society, people don't have a concept of what the good is to begin with. They don't know what it is, so there's no room for choice. You see. Our concept of what the good is a completely different idea. Our concept of the good is really, to me, personally, it's expressed in one tefillah, very clearly. You know what the tefillah is? Which tefillah? In my mind, there's one tefillah that expresses exactly, what the real good is. The tefillah is the L'kayinah Tzar, right after Shemana Esrei. That's the tefillah. Because that tefillah really says, L'kayinah Tzar Shanim Meira, U'sfasayim Yidaber Mirma, because that's based on the whole concept of Lashon Hara, which means that in man, the instinct is expressed through verbalization. Okay, so that's the tefillah. He says, "V'lem kalalai nafshi sidon." Those that curse me, I shouldn't answer them. The nafshi ke'ofer lakol tiyah. That means to say that the person is it's completely diametrically opposed to the whole drive of success of the American society. Exactly the opposite. I shouldn't desire the slightest recognition. I should be considered like dust, and it shouldn't bother me. See, once a person realizes that the good is not to be gained through other human beings' recognition, through what this society calls success, you see, it's exact opposite. Exact opposite, he says. Then it says, means who is the happy person? The happy person is the person that's not into any of these desires, but he only has one desire, just to understand Chachmas Hashem. That is the happiness, that is success. If a person doesn't have that concept, then there's no bechira. He simply, it's a matter of making a choice. It's like a person wants to make a choice between being a physician or being a lawyer. Okay, it's a choice, but the choice is going to be based on the same exact framework. I mean, which one you're going to enjoy more, which one are you going to be more successful about? It's not bechira. That's a question of a tug of war between two emotions, and you'll choose the one that's better for you. But over here, it's a different concept of the good. It's a different kind. So Yadus demands of a person an amazing thing, that a person, even though he's on the instinctual level, should search for a good that he might not be able to at that point even perceive. Yeah, he can't even perceive, he doesn't even experience it. But he has to know that it exists. He can understand the description of it in his mind, and he has to realize that is the only place that will really give him a satisfying life, a happy existence. And that is a happy existence, that is the good, that is man, and that's the ultimate state. You see, even though emotionally he's being drawn everywhere else. Okay. That's why Yadis demands of a person. That's why Yadis, in today's society, it's like he says, the Ibn Ezra says it very nicely. He says a person, what's the lesson over there? He says a person That's the society. This society is that they're oskim b'chilush siya. Chilush siya doesn't mean eating and drinking. It means they do plenty of that too, but it means really all these emotional types, all the types. They can't even perceive. Lo yechkam lo olam means they can't even perceive an idea that you should be searching for a good that has nothing to do with any of these things. An idea is alien to them. Now, it's an interesting thing. He said like this. There's one other point I wanted to make. And that point is, ubeschaber neshama im ruach tenatzcheno hanefesh. Oz ti pokachna ma'at enei haneshama lohovin chochmos agvios. Lochein lo sucha ladasa chochmos olyonos. All right, so he divides chochma into two parts. It's an interesting thing. He says that the person can know chochmos agvios, and he will not know Chachmas Alyonos. What are the Chachmas Alyonos and what are the Chachmas Agvios? See, what are these two Chachmas? What is he talking about? Doesn't say exactly what it is. But he says the Chachmas Alyonos you'll only know if you escape from the Ruach. So the Ruach can only get you into a lower Chachma. But then you have to escape. It's like a rocket. You have to use a booster. Then you have to drop the booster, because that's it. But if you keep hanging on to the booster, it's going to... Exactly. So the booster is the Ruach, but then you have to drop it. Okay? Yes. What you're saying is like this, that if the person has self-control, so then he can force himself to study medicine. But his knowledge is limited to that area. He's limited to medicine. That's correct. But the what I like to start, I like to start first with a premise. The premise is like this, and this is an important premise in Yadis. The premise is that a person's psychological makeup, what I mean, I don't mean psychological, I mean philosophical, metaphysical makeup is a better word. A person's metaphysical makeup is extremely important in determining what kind of chachma he has. If no matter how intelligent he is, I don't care how intelligent he is, if his neshama is on a certain level where it can't, where for instance when the ruach is in control, so he, no matter how intelligent he is, he cannot have knowledge of certain areas. It's impossible, virtually impossible. Virtually impossible. This is something which is the yesod in Yadis. That's why Yadis has the concept of a Talmud Chacham. A Talmud Chacham means not a person that knows a subject. It means a person that's all Chachma. Every area he works under Chachma. It's not simply how intelligent he is, but it's a functional concept. It means that the mind is functioning in a certain way. There are no restrictions. No restrictions. A person who is under the Ruach is under Ruach is restricted. And he can be the greatest genius in one area, and he can be a total idiot in another area. There's somebody from history that I would show as an example of this, and I would say Galileo. Galileo was without a doubt one of the greatest minds in physics that there ever was. I mean, basically, he was the founder of the whole modern physics, and Newton expanded tremendously on what he started. But he really laid the ground in concepts. He was a genius, and he established the whole methodology. And he broke away from the old Greek approach, and he created a new kind of approach to science, which really is actually his whole approach was quantitative description. He saw that in nature you can't try to jump to essences. It's too quick. You got to pull back. And you have to be involved in the chachma of quantitative analysis of nature. That's where mathematical equations come in. He was the one that discovered the function, the concept of a function. And all Newton's things are really based on his basic principles. He was really the innovator. He was the innovator. Yes, that's right. That's right. Kepler with the astronomer. Yes, astronomer mathematics. But the whole scientific approach is the mathematical analysis. What is mathematical analysis? It means quantitative description of nature. And he was the innovator of the whole approach, which led to tremendous discoveries. He pulled back from, he showed that man is too quick to try to understand essences. Nature is too complex. You must first understand the quantitative analysis. Okay? And the truth of the matter is, today physics is in a quandary because the Galileo's method of quantitative analysis is not working at this point in physics. And that's why there are big problems. It's hard to find they can't find a new method, and the old method just does not bore fruit, but it's exhausted now. And they're at the point now, a crisis, where really it would appear that someone has to come along with a new approach. That's my opinion, but anyways. The point I wanted to make is like this. Galileo, the great innovator, okay, was nevertheless, when it came to the area of Derech HaChaim, was like a total fool. Because he was, you know the story with him in the church. And I mean, in the church, basically, they had to recant. They forced him to recant. They persecuted the man. And he tied it to the church. He tied it to the Pope. He said to him, I'm not denying God. He says, I'm trying to show, chokhmah, the chokhmah of God. And they persecuted the man because their position is that a person that makes a new discovery and uncovers chokhmah Hashem should be tortured. That's their position. That's why I say that is the greatest absurdity when they have the Pope should come here to give his opinion, his evaluation of the ethical standards of this country. This country was created precisely to escape the kind of persecution that this man represents. Because they believe in the, first of all, it's not just a historical thing. Because you see, they have a doctrine that they believe in the infallibility of the papacy. It means the Pope cannot make a mistake. So basically, if they persecuted Galileo, that was the right thing to do. As a matter of fact, they recently pardoned him. But what does it mean they pardoned him? I want you to misunderstand it. Pardon does not mean that they made a mistake. Pardon means now they let him go out of purgatory. They got purgatory. They say, holy, he's burning there. And now he's allowed to go out. They don't make any mistakes. No such mistakes. So they maintain, here is a man that believes actually that a scientist that comes up with a new discovery should be tortured. Okay? And he believes that the Inquisition, which was done by the popes, was instituted by the popes, and was carried out with a tortured hundreds and thousands of innocent people, killed them, tortured and killed them, that this is justice. So it's ironic that a country which was created to escape the kind of evil that this man represents and believes in, that now he's invited to judge the ethics of this country. Does that make any sense? It's absurd. It's the height of absurdity. Okay? But Galileo, who saw this, I mean, basically, he saw what he's up against. He wrote himself, he says he never lost his veneration and great respect for the church and his own conscience. So here you see a person who was such a great genius in the area of physics, the greatest of geniuses, one in the entire existence of the history of the whole civilization, basically, one yachid b'yishev yachidim. But when it came to the area of knowledge of how to live, metaphysical, not even abstract metaphysical knowledge, just the simple logic to see that this is and if you believe that uncovering nature is uncovering Chochmas Hashem, it's a facto an institution that wants to destroy people that do this has got to be evil. But he never lost his respect for the church. How is it possible? That's the Ibn Ezra. Chochmas HaGvios, you know. To measurement of physical bodies, he was very good at. But when it came to any kind of understanding of Derech HaChayim and what the good is, not even the ethical good. I'm not talking about metaphysics. I'm not talking about abstract Maisa Merkava, Maisa Bereishis. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the simple ethics. His mind was completely blinded. Blinded by a respect and a reverence that was simply that he was raised in and he couldn't escape from. Why? What component of the mind does that come from, that reverence? What component? Ruach. That's Ruach. That's Ruach. That's from Ruach. See? Ruach. He was a man of Ruach. Man of Ruach, and he succeeded in Chochmas HaGvias. But he couldn't succeed when it came to the area of, that's what the Ibn Ezra means by the Chochmas Alyonos. Chochmas Alyonos. And that's the same thing is true of many, many people in the past. I mean, you have to be very, that's why a person has to be very careful. When a person studies other great men, you have to know where this person's greatness lies, exactly. If he's restricted by the Ruach, you see, I don't care how intelligent he is, I could show you the greatest genius, but in this area, he could never get to the, that's what Ibn Ezra says. He says he will never be able, he says, L'chein lo sucha lo das ha-chochmos olyanos. That's what I said. Impossible to know it. I don't care how intelligent. There's nothing to do with the caliber of his intelligence. Okay? That's the Ibn Ezra. That's why Yadus is a concept, as I said before, of a Talmud Chacham. Torah is not just is not a subject. Torah is something which actually creates a certain personality. The personality of Talmud Chacham, where Chochmas HaTorah pervades every aspect of his existence. There's no limitation. That's what Yadus tried to produce. Yadus tries to produce a certain gavra, where the Chochma reigns supreme, unrestricted. In the world, you have great Chachamim. But when you study their lives, you see right away, it's almost without exception, you'll find the restrictions. You just search enough, you see, you'll find the restrictions. I can only think of very rare exceptions. Yes. It's possible that it can exist. The only thing is that the nature of Torah is such that it wages a war against such a kind of a personality. Because it drags him into every area. It drags him into Mishlei, into Kehelas, into Nevi'im, into every area is taken up in Torah. So if, what? Besides the halachic system. So therefore, it's almost impossible for a person to get out of this subject and just be one-dimensional and be limited. But it's possible. That's what Chazal warned against. It's possible. But it is a yotzei min haklal. Whereas other subjects simply have nothing. A person can study the movements of falling bodies and know the equations, but has no bearing whatsoever on his personal life. Okay? You shouldn't confuse that with b'mufresh b'mchal tidrash. A person has to be able to recognize limitations and know he can't. And know he can't handle, he can't tackle the problem. It's just the problem's too big. So he accepts the Masorah, the conclusion, and he goes on to problems that he can't handle. So that's something else. That's all part of the institution of Ruach. See, Ruach looks for respect. It's impressed with respect and with a certain kind of self-image. See, it's really, when he said, actually when Galileo made a statement, he mentions conscience. Conscience is Ruach. He mentions it. He said, I never lost my reverence for the church and for my own conscience. See? Reverence for conscience is, it means he was a servant of Ruach. A servant of Ruach, yeah. We say that conscience is Ruach, it can get you to a certain point, the Ibn Ezra says. Certain point, you'd be conscientious. So you don't give in to your tithes. But Biyadus maintains there's a level above that. The level above that is Neshama. That's what the Ibn Ezra says. That's
what the Rambam said about
her. Since conscience in Yadus is a dangerous, the dangerous thing. You have to know when to use it as a tool. But it is not something which we don't, the rest of the world says, let your conscience be your guide. We don't believe in such a thing. That's just another emotion. There's only one guide, and the guide is Torah. And Torah and Chachma. That's the only guide. That's the difference, really, specifically, and specific, spelled out definitively between Yadus and between the other systems. Galileo was a worshiper of conscience. Worshiper of conscience can worship the church. And as crazy as they are, he couldn't think. He sees this is a system that's destroying what he believes. Nevertheless, that's it. Lo yuchal ladas. He cannot have any knowledge in that area.